This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Love now and
did you fall in love last time?
I love
love was stronger than anything.
For the love,
love. And I love you more than anything.
There's to love.
Love.
From the New York Times, I'm Anna Martin. This is Modern Love. I recently went through a friend breakup. It was one of those slow motion kind of implosions, misinterpretations and mistakes building up little by little until it all exploded in a painful public argument on the sidewalk. Even though I know it was right to end this friendship, the ending was just so messy. This week's essay is about a relationship that needs to end for both people involved. And the author is trying to avoid the kind of explosion that I experienced. He's trying to end things gradually, gently, but he's struggling. The essay is called After 264 Haircuts, A Marriage Ends, written by William Dameron and read by Eduardo Ballerini.
Elizabeth lofted the black cape, and I watched it billow in front of me like a sheet blossoming on a clothesline. She fastened the buttons around my neck, placed her hands on either side of my head, and whispered, "I can't do this anymore." "Do what?" I asked. "This," she said, gesturing around us. "I have to let you go." Still, she reached into a black case and pulled out scissors and a comb. "Who will cut your hair?" she asked. I shrugged my shoulders. She pulled up a swath of hair with a comb and began to snip. When we first met, in the 1980s, I wore my hair parted on the side, a preppy, conservative look. On our second date, she swept back my bangs with her fingertips and offered to cut my hair for the first time. Over the years, so many clumps of my dark hair have slid down the cape and pooled on the kitchen floor. "Do you have the clippers?" I asked. She reached into the case and pulled them out. When she turned them on, they gave off a low electronic buzz. "Cut it all off," I said. "What?" "I want you to buzz it all off." If I didn't have any hair, it wouldn't matter that I no longer had her to cut it. "Go on," I said. "Do it." I watched the hair tumble onto the cape, her breasts pressed against my shoulder as her hand brushed the hair from my head. And then I felt something wet fall on my cheek. I heard a sound like a hiccup, and then I heard it again, like someone trying to catch a breath. Her tears kept falling. She held up a mirror, and I winced. "Oh, man," I said. There was something honest and bold about the look. "Shave off the rest." "But you'll look like a cancer patient." "It's just hair." She finished the haircut. As if my thoughts had been laid bare too, she said, "You know I'm stronger now. I can make it on my own." "I know that," I said. "For 2 months, ever since I moved out, we had been engaged in a dance of me visiting to keep contact with our girls. On the weekend, I would stay in our home in Virginia as if nothing had changed." But everything had changed. She rubbed lotion on my neck and pulled out the straight razor. I felt the cool metal on my skin as she nudged my head forward and down with her fingertips. I closed my eyes. I could hear our 14-year-old daughter chattering on the telephone and laughter coming from the TV. "I didn't cheat on you," I said, keeping my head down and my eyes closed. The blade stood still for a moment, then skimmed down the back of my neck. "I had to get that HIV test," she said, "because you were acting so out of character." I was offended when she had first told me this. How many times had we made love? Was it greater or fewer than the number of haircuts? Of course, the test was negative. I could count on one hand the number of people I'd been intimate with before her. The first was my childhood neighbor in Greensboro, North Carolina. He and I were too young to understand our dark fumbling during sleepovers. In college, I lost my virginity to Sally, a red-haired flute player. It was a rite of passage that I simply wanted to get over. When I was 20 and in Colorado for the summer with my Aunt Sheila and her psychic girlfriend, I stumbled out of a bar on the edge of town walking arm in arm with Don, my aunt's handsome young friend. Under the shadow of Pike's Peak, he and I kissed. I heard Sheila's voice in the distance calling out, "He's not sure if he's gay yet, Don." But I knew. When I first started seeing Elizabeth at 21, I told her about Sally, but not Don. That part of my life was supposed to have been erased by conversion therapy. I prayed with my mother at the dining room table every day not to be the way I was. The first time Elizabeth and I had sex was on a sofa in my brother's off-campus apartment in Raleigh, North Carolina. Neither of us was a virgin, so there was no awkward fumbling, just as there was no passionate taboo. I recognized it for what it was. This was as good as it could get. For more than 22 years, after our daughters were born, and as my hair became grayer, and Elizabeth's body became softer, I kept my secret locked away. Then on a Wednesday night in a Walmart parking lot, Elizabeth saved me. "Are you gay?" she asked. "I don't want to be," I said. Shortly after, our marriage ended. But while I was still making my weekend visits, there was Ray. On our second date, I ripped the clothes off his body. Afterward, he held up his pants and examined the broken zipper and popped button. "Those were my favorite pants," he said. I laughed. He did not. Elizabeth brushed the hair from my shoulders and removed the cape. I stood up, put on my shirt, and pulled the broom from the kitchen closet to sweep up. When the girls went to bed, I wandered the house, taking stock of things that were no longer mine. There on the dining room table was the blue metal pitcher we found in an antique shop in New Hampshire. This painting, above the brick mantel, was my 20th wedding anniversary gift to her. Here was the sofa where Elizabeth and I once lay side by side with a sleeping dog at our feet. The wooden floors creaked as I passed. When I reached the top of the stairs, Elizabeth stood motionless in the dark hall. "Can I sleep with you? Just sleep? This one last night?" I asked. "Don't wake me in the morning," she said. She removed her nightgown. I took off my shirt. That was her side of the bed, and this used to be mine. Here was the blue comforter where we cradled our newborn girls. These were the pillows, flattened with use. I lay awake on my back. She rested her hand on my neck. I turned to my right side, and she to her left, as we twisted in our bittersweet ballet of goodbye. In the grainy morning light, I closed the bedroom door and tiptoed to my daughter's rooms. This was Sophie's. Those were the boxes filled with her dolls. I tucked her dark hair behind her ear and kissed her warm cheek. Here was Marissa's. These were her glasses. I picked them up and cleaned them with the tail of my shirt. "I'm just going to work now," I muttered, a half-truth in the half-light. This, behind me, was the house full of secrets, and here before me was the path that lay ahead. This is what I left. An empty chair at the table. The scent of my skin on the sheets. An old painting a sleeping dog, a blue pitcher, my lingering shadow on the front steps before I let go.
That final haircut happened 15 years ago. We'll find out what's happened since then with Bill's kids and his love life after the break.
This podcast is supported by Cartier.
Shortly after my father passed away, I was just really sad. So one of my best friends invited me to have dinner with his family. It was getting later and later. So his wife came in and she brought a pillow, sheets, a blanket. And then she told me that I was going to stay with them for a while. She told me that because she knew I was sad. And they gave me that family room for a couple of days and they took care of me. They made sure I ate, made sure I was just loved and protected. When I left, I felt strong. And I felt I was ready to deal with the world.
With love, from Cartier.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Hello, Bill.
Hello, Anna.
Your essay is so beautiful, and it's also really complicated at the end. There's so much uncertainty, but I also feel like there's this very distinct sense of hope.
Yeah.
When did the final haircut in this essay, when did it happen?
It happened in 2007.
And how old were your girls at the time?
They were 14 and 16. I had come out to them that year.
How did that conversation go when you came out to them?
We called a family meeting. They were annoyed because it was a Sunday afternoon and they wanted to spend time with their friends. They had no idea what was coming.
Right.
I remember my younger daughter was like looking at the split ends of her hair.
Well, she was 14.
She was 14 and hair is very important at 14. And I told them there was something that I've known since I was a young child. And it's something I've known that you don't know. But when I tell you, I'm still the same person. It's just that you're going to know. And that thing is that I'm gay.
Wow.
Then when I said it, they looked at their mother. They looked at me. But there really wasn't that realization yet. It was more of a surprise, like, okay, you're gay. And then it was, wait, are you getting divorced? And so I had to be honest about that too, which was, we are talking about it. And at that point, they kind of both ran out of the house. And my ex-wife ran after them, leaving me sitting alone in the living room, wondering what I had just done. And I did what most dads do. I went outside and started to mow the yard. Because that was my routine.
You started doing yard work. Yard work as a coping mechanism. Yeah, very dad. And how did it feel to say those words? How did it feel when you actually said them?
It is an interesting mix of emotions because it was devastation for my daughters, but it was also coming clean and telling the truth. And telling the truth, as devastating and painful as it was, also meant that we could heal. But you mentioned before the little bit of hope that seemed to be in my essay, and that was there in me too. I knew that in order to get to a better place, I had to go all the way through.
So, Bill, after coming out, moving out, there is sort of a light, there's a hope. You did find love.
I did.
And I want to know, how did you meet him?
So I met Paul through the old-fashioned way, online. We were both gay dads, as it turned out. For me, it was very important that I meet somebody or be with someone who also had children so that they understood me. Mm. We talked for a while on the phone and then decided to meet at a Cheesecake Factory.
Wait, I love Cheesecake Factory. Why Cheesecake Factory?
Because I had moved to a basement apartment and I'm horrible with directions and I really didn't know where anything was, but I knew where the Cheesecake Factory was.
You said it was important for you to date another father. Why was it important to you?
He actually said it on our first date. He said, "I know that I would never be number one. You have a one and a two and I'll be three." And he understood that. And he actually pulled out the pictures of his kids and placed them on the table. Mm. I pulled out mine. They were kind of ratty and stuck to my wallet. And so all five pictures of our kids were there on the table with us on the first date.
I love it. How long have you and Paul been together?
We've been together now 15 years.
Wow.
We've been married for 12 years.
And are you close with Paul's kids, those kids you saw their photos on the table?
I think I might actually be closer to them than he is. His kids talk to me about the things that are bothering them. And most people mistake our daughters for actually being biological sisters because they act so much alike and they have relationships that are like sisters in the best possible way.
How does that feel for you?
It feels fantastic. It really does. It feels like, yeah, this was meant to be for all of us to be truthful finally. And now my kids know me in a way that they never would have known me. I had to do a lot of therapy to understand what I had done. There was a lot of collateral damage. And so I knew I needed to work to repair that. But it sort of came back together in a way that is even stronger and better than it could have ever been before.
Bill, I think that that's a gorgeous place to end us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anna.
On the next Modern Love, a daughter longs to connect with her father and the place where he grew up.
We didn't visit Puerto Rico, so we didn't know a lot. And I think that made him sad.
Why a man who missed his homeland felt he had to destroy his connection to it. Next week. Modern Love is produced by Julia Botero, Hans Buto, Christina Josa, and Elissa Dudley. It's edited by Sarah Saracen. This episode was mixed by Dan Powell, who also created our Modern Love theme music. Original music by Dan Powell and Roman Nemisto. Digital production by Mahima Chablani and Nell Galogli, and a special thanks to Anna Diamond at Autumn. The Modern Love column is edited by Daniel Jones. Mia Lee is the editor of Modern Love Projects. I'm Anna Martin. Thanks for listening.